Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome back to Conversations. I'm very pleased to be joined today by a distinguished historian at Princeton, Sean Wilentz, a longtime history professor there, author of the terrific and magisterial book, I think I can say that if it's 1,000 pages, right? The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. A most recent book, I believe, is on slavery and anti-slavery at the founding, a very hot topic, you might want to say, no property in man. So, and also Sean has written for many journals and participated in our, you know, public life and discussing contemporary politics as well. So it's really a pleasure to have you on, Sean.
I'm delighted to be here, Bill. Great to see you.
I want to talk about history and America and current controversies and stuff. But I thought, actually, we were talking last weekend just to get ready for this. I think I called you, and it was just within 24 hours of John Lewis's death, and you were you said you were sort of not shaken by it, but I mean moved by it, and I was moved too, but I didn't really know him well. But you knew him pretty well, and say a word about that because it's so relevant. You just, I think, wrote a eulogy that's just coming out in Democracy Magazine. Of Congressman Lewis too.
Yeah, you know, even when you know it's coming, it's always hard. You know, and we knew that John was very sick, and he probably wasn't going to make it. But still, when it finally happens, it's a loss. I mean, I got to know John in the mid '90s, doing a piece on him, and we spent about a year very, very close contact. He gave me full access. I followed him around, talked to his friends, did a lot of research for this piece, actually.
Who was the piece for?
Well, it ended up in the New Republic, and it's probably the, of all the pieces I've written that are not strictly historical, right, that are at the cusp of politics, it's probably the one I'm the most proud of, the proudest of. Because he brought that out. I mean, he became very quickly a mentor and a teacher in many ways, and a friend, and a good friend. So, we had some good times together, and I'm able to write about them in this little eulogy.
Obviously he was an extraordinary man, a man of great courage, and you look back at the early days of the Civil Rights Movement, he was so young, but you must have talked to you a lot about that. What struck you? What's different from the sort of public face of him? I mean,
well, there are two things. I mean, first of all, on the public face, a lot of the eulogies and the tributes that are coming out about John stress his spiritual side and his courage. I mean, he was, you know, he would get his head beaten up. He would go into racist waiting rooms and get beaten up more regularly than others. He just had that, what they called satyagraha. I mean, this idea of truth force, you know, that came out of Gandhi and came out of King. I mean, he really had that. And it's a spiritual thing that you either have or you don't, and he did. And that's all true about John. But he also was a very, very savvy and, you know, somewhat hard-nosed, even cold political figure when he had to be. And he learned his lessons, actually, in the 60s when he was, in effect, dumped from SNCC, from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when Stokely Carmichael overthrew him, and it was the beginning of Black Power, and he was kind of in a daze for a while, and then got back into politics. But, you know, I think he learned a lot from that episode about how politics actually operates, that sometimes you cannot simply be spiritual.
Yeah.
And so he really combined, actually, that hard-edged political savvy with, you know, this great spiritual and presence that better than anybody I've ever seen. So that was number one about him. But yes, as I was getting to know him, we talked a lot about his young days in the movement, in the civil rights movement, and he happened to have just started writing his own memoirs. Actually, his memoirs are great. I recommend it to anyone who wants to learn about the inside of the civil rights movement in the 60s. His book called Walking with the Wind is actually beautifully written memoir. But he was on top of all of his stories. So he was telling me these stories, and he'd tell me all of these stories in great detail. You know, I mean, it was a kind of a set piece, the story of what happened at Selma in March 1965, the famous Bloody Sunday, when he and Hosea Williams led a march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and that's when they were all beaten by the Alabama State Troopers. But he was telling me what he had in his backpack that day.
I mean, you know, you can see the photos of him. I mean, he's, what, 20, 25 years old, then, I think. 24, 25.
He's 25. That's exactly
yeah.
right. He's
and he has this backpack. Yeah, it's kind of. So what's it, yeah? So I've always wondered what's in your backpack when you're right. about to encounter Alabama State troopers who are going to beat you up.
He didn't know that he was going to get beaten, but he did figure, as they all did any time, that they were going to get arrested. So he had the things that he needed, which was to say, he had a toothbrush, a toothpaste, some fruit, an apple, and maybe a banana, and two books. But the books, it was interesting. He remembered, and the books were Richard Hofstadter's The American Political Tradition. Now, when I heard that, I was,
That's amazing, yeah.
And a book of Thomas Merton's. I don't know if it was The Seven Story Mountain. I can't remember which title, but it doesn't matter. So again, it was history and the spiritual. They also both went to Columbia, which I did too, so that was nice. But or they had Columbia connections. But, but we were talking about that. And that little story in itself, actually, summarized a lot about him. Because he was interested in both, the history of the country, what the country's politics were about. He got more and more interested in that as he got older. But then there was this spiritual side that Merton conveyed to him. So that was him in his backpack. And then, of course, he makes history with that. So it's an extraordinary fellow. I'll just never forget him or those memories. It's just so I'm sad to see him go, and he's the last of a continuity in my own life in politics too. I mean, he told me a story once. We were talking about 1968, which was a horrible year in many ways, particularly if we were liberal. I mean, it was a disaster. And he spoke about what it felt like after Dr. King, who was his mentor. Martin Luther King was his great, great mentor. How he dealt with King's assassination, and he said, it was searing. It was so impossible to comprehend. But he kept thinking, at least Bobby Kennedy's still alive.
Hmm.
At least Bobby Kennedy's still alive. And of course, that was going to last for 2 months. And in a way, John was the last link, if you will, or the last he stood for that continuum, from King, from the Civil Rights Movement, through that part of liberal politics in the late 60s that just exploded. I mean, in effect, it died with Kennedy, but he was keeping on that keeping with that mission. So so he's gone now too, and there it is.
I mean, for me, apart from admiring him in sort of general, and then it just reading about him, looking at some of the video, actually, of the, mm-hmm. of the 65, 63, when he speaks at the March in Washington, and
yes.
he's 23 years old or something. So that was, 55 years ago, the March at Selma. And it does sort of bring, the continuity, I suppose, of American history home. Because 55 years before that is, 1910, let's say. So where mm-hmm. Wilson's about to resegregate the, mm-hmm, Jim Crow mm-hmm. is settling it in the South. Wilson's about to resegregate mm-hmm. the civil service and so forth. Other things before World War I. 55 years before that is the Civil War, basically. I mean, it is sort of amazing how, these things are so long ago, but they're not that many lifetimes ago. And I imagine someone like Lewis, and we can get off Lewis and talk more generally, but I mean, would have been very conscious of this kind of, just the history and the immediacy in a way of the past, I guess.
I think more as he got older. I mean, I think he came to it, out of the church because he had been a boy preacher and so forth. But, Bill, we're a very young country. I mean, my colleagues sometimes think that I'm basically really a journalist because American history is only 400, 500 years old. It's nothing. But it means that when you view these things, as you say, they're always within a lifetime of each other. Nothing's too far away.
So say a word about. Let's talk about American history. It is amazing how much history is in the middle of our current debates, the monuments and the memorials, and how to write. That's the most immediate. That, of course, you were involved in the controversy over the 1619 Project, which mm-hmm. we should get mm-hmm. to in a minute, and mm-hmm. how to think about the beginning of slavery in the continent, as opposed to, or in addition to, I guess maybe the founding and the Declaration and so forth. So it's all. I'm always struck when I talk to Europeans. You say your colleagues make fun of you. It's true. Europeans are very much, you know, we have real history here. We have Notre Dame in charge or whatever, and you have this kind of current events. You know. But it's,
I've got Disney. You have Disneyland, they say to me.
But I'm always struck sort of by the opposite, which is Americans are much more historical now, I believe. Europeans have, for understandable reasons, sort of decided to leave history behind in many ways. Yeah. Of course, some of them know a lot. I don't mean, but it's not at their shoulder the way. Look at the emotions that are stirred by changing the name of an army base or taking down or putting up a statue. And so, I mean, so say a word in general about, I guess, America and history, and then maybe we can go to the founding and sort of talk a little bit about the more, you know, concretely about what is to be learned from American history, so to speak.
I mean, the United States, the Civil War in effect never really ended. I mean, I think that's at the core of what we're talking about. I mean, the French Revolution kind of ended. The Glorious Revolution kind of ended in Britain. But our Civil War is still, the legacy of that is still very much with us, in part because of what happened in the aftermath of the war, that you had this effort at Reconstruction that was overthrown. And so the history of Jim Crow thereafter, you know, it really hasn't ended. And the fight over the monuments actually is indicative of that, because while it got way out of hand and it got into, you know, craziness, I think, about, you know, taking down the monument. Well, it's actually still continuing. The monument of anybody who had anything to do with slavery at any time, no matter how great their contributions were in any way. I mean, this is to me madness. But the stuff about the Confederate monuments was very real, not simply because they were memorializing the Confederacy or memorializing, you know, white supremacy, whatever you want to call it, but they were part of a very conscious political strategy from the 1880s through around the 1910s, 1920s, which was it obviously had a lot to do with the war, but it was about, in effect, proclaiming the lost cause, saying that, in fact, the lost cause was not a lost cause, that the lost cause had triumphed again in the aftermath of Reconstruction, and that we are in charge. And now, we may not hold national power, but we sure hold power here, and don't you forget it, and here's this statue to remind you of what it's all about. Now, was it that direct and in your face? Sometimes. There's a speech that Jefferson Davis gives at some point in the 80s, not long before he died, in front of a big crowd saying, you know, here we are, you know, Dixie is back. Other times it was more subtle, but nevertheless, that's what it was about. So it's not just about the old history, it's about the history that was being made out of the history that had been made. And so we're still living with that. I mean, it's very recent. And then, of course, there are the social problems. I mean, we still have, terrible problems with race relations, et cetera. It's still there. It's not gone away. And it's been... what's happened recently actually reminds me a little bit of what happened with John Lewis, which was, you know, there were ways in which the footage of what happened at Selma really did awaken people who had not quite understood what the situation was in the South, or might have thought, you know, okay, maybe it's terrible, but really are they? Well, that really, you know, showed how violence was at the bottom of everything. You know, at the end, that's it. It's about violence. And I think that the pictures out of Minneapolis, although it's obviously a different situation, but to see graphically, to see that that event with George Floyd, I think a lot of Americans, particularly white Americans, you know, who might have, you know, not quite understood what was going on, that they still had a problem with some police somewhere. I think that it was so shocking, you know, to see that. That it awakened people. So there are these moments, you know, in history where in effect the public consciousness or some of it kind of snaps, and now everything gets opened up, and that's what we're dealing with now, right? I mean, everything gets opened up,
which is not bad in some ways, right? Because
it's exhausting.
Well, it leads to you learn stuff, and it leads to debate. It is just the one point, and on the Selma thing that I had not realized. I remembered as a 12-year-old, I guess I would have been, watching, you know, vaguely watching it, and my parents being outraged, you know, upset, and of course, and all that. But I had sort of forgotten how immediate what you say is right. I mean, I think it was a week later that Johnson spoke to Congress and said, we've got to pass the Voting Rights Act. And I think it passed a few months later. So, I mean, it was actually a very big moment. It wasn't just, gee, that was a dramatic thing that, you know, people talked about afterwards. So.
Well, this is important, Bill. What you say is very important because, and it goes to Johnson's abilities as a politician. When you have these moments of, what, public consciousness cracking or something opens up, the window is very small. You don't have a lot of time before people start forgetting again. I suppose now even more so because the you know our attention spans have dwindled, but Johnson understood that and he saw a moment and he seized that moment and he gave that speech which, you know, supposedly made Martin Luther King cry, weep when he says we shall overcome at the end, and then he got the Voting Rights Act, as you say. I mean, had he waited 6 months, that wouldn't have happened, and this is why the current situation is so odd, because it's happening, not just in the middle of a political season, but it's happening amidst this contagion. And so what is going to be made out of it is not anywhere near as clear politically or in any other way as it could have been in 1965. You know, there's no political leader to step forward and make the most out of this reassessment we're going through. So we're all going through it together, and it's messy.
Yeah, maybe that's in some ways, you know, healthy if communities can come together and so forth. But of course, violence doesn't help on the one hand and demagoguery on the other. So I suppose that's the challenge, right? I
mean, well, that's our challenge. That's what we're trying to do is to keep some seat of reason and talk. Actually, it gives it opportunity for people across all sorts of lines to actually reason together, as long as, you know, it goes back to Arthur Schlesinger's idea of the vital center. There is a vital center and there are these extremes out there. And if we can recreate it, maybe that's something that Trump has done, actually, is to help recreate the vital center where people who otherwise might have been, we're still going to fight. That's fine. But we also say we're going to fight among each other. But we're not that. And we're not that. We're not the more extreme social justice warriors on the other side. We're not that. There is a center that we can share. That might actually be a good thing. Coming out of it politically, that could arise, but we got a long way to go.
I mean, how hopeful or not hopeful are you about that? I mean, university presidents, community leaders, governors, mayors—you know, obviously church leaders. I mean, yeah, in principle, one could say, look, on the one hand, this—it's reasonable to remove this. I'm making this up. I mean, remove this monument or statue from this place because it really was put up with a certain intention, and it's not someone we want to be honoring. And we shouldn't have mob violence, presumably, to tear it down, but we can remove it. On the other hand, as you say, someone who was a great American who happened to not be as anti-slavery as we would now like him to have been 200 years later, that's a different matter.
Yes.
And
yes,
are people, I mean, how hopeful are you that, I take it that's kind of where you would want things to, the kinds of distinctions you'd want made, and how, tell us about the distinctions, I guess, and then how hopeful are you that they can be made?
I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this. I mean, I do think that there's a case to be made for the getting rid of the Confederate statues. Many of my, you know, Southern white friends don't agree, and we have to agree to disagree. But I think that that's a very specific thing that you ought not to think about. I mean, look, at one point in where was it? I can't remember. A statue in San Francisco, a statue of U.S. Grant was toppled. Now, this is, to me, crazy, right?
Right.
I mean, just crazy. Because, in fact, his father-in-law, he grew up in an abolitionist family, Grant did, in Ohio. But he married this a Southern gal, and his father-in-law was, you know, an unlikable fellow no matter what, but he was also a slaveholder. And he actually gave Ulysses Grant, the young Ulysses Grant, who was very poor at the time, a slave, which Grant then promptly, I think within a year or so, freed and got rid of, and that was the end of it. That's what people don't like about him and why they're pulling down his statue, which is, here's the man who vanquished the Confederacy and went on as president to, you know, break the Klan and all the rest.
And was actually, for his time, one of the most enlightened, shall we say, on race, right? In general, I mean, really tried hard. His presidency overshadowed by scandals and so forth, but he really tried hard, I think, to carry through on the healthy side of Reconstruction.
And I think that's right. Exactly. And at any rate, so to see him Grant be trashed was, you know, an look, in these moments, you also get people doing what excesses. Excess sounds like a euphemism, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, you get crazy people doing things, and you have to crack down on that, and you have to say, don't do that. And I've actually seen that in some of the demonstrations here in Trenton, for example. There was a moment where I was watching, there was a demonstration going on, and they were getting very angry at the police. But then the police showed that they were basically on their side. But there were still some kids in the back who were throwing bottles, water bottles and stuff, right? And the crowd turned on the bottle throwers and said, no, you don't do that. So it was an interesting moment where you saw the excesses were being curbed. But to your larger question, I look, I'm preternaturally hopeful. That's the only way we can keep going. But I think that things are actually better politically, funnily enough, than they are culturally. I think we've been living under this abnormal administration for three years going on four. And I think that if that were repudiated in no uncertain terms, then I think the chances for normal politics to resume could happen. And we haven't had normal politics for a very long time anyway. I mean, it's been crazy for a very long time, and it oughtn't to be. I'm more hopeful on that score, looking at the latest polls or what have you. I mean, it's going to be a ways to go, but nevertheless, than I am culturally. I think culturally things are much more unsettled, and in the universities and the foundations elsewhere, there's more hardened ideology, I think, out there. When you have to appeal to the voters are pretty sensible. And so in politics, as I think you saw during the Democratic primaries in the end, I mean, when the Democratic voters actually voted, they came up with their candidate. Now, whether you like him or not, nevertheless, to my mind, he was a sensible candidate. But when you don't have voters,
right.
It can get pretty, pretty crazy. And so I worry about the extent to which in the university, in publishing, in some of our leading cultural institutions, whether we're going to come out of this quite as well as we should. We'll see.
Yeah. And so say a little more about that, just because, since I'm more on the political side, I get worried about Trumpism that I think we will have for now a normal Democratic Party, so to speak, with former vice president leading it and so forth. I won't agree with it on some things, many things, but it will be recognizably in the mainstream of the American tradition. On the Republican and conservative side, I'm more worried that sort of Trumpism doesn't go away and there's a kind of authoritarianism and mean-spiritedness and nativism that has been unleashed, and victimization that's been unleashed. So that's the political, I think, challenge. It does seem to me like the political challenge is a little more from the right, but the cultural challenge is more from a kind of illiberalism of the left. And so, well, say a word about the politics if you want, but especially I'm interested in I go back and forth on how bad I'm not in the universities, I'm not in publishing, I'm not in the foundations much, so I sort of sometimes hear people complain and think, oh, you're probably overdoing it, but then I read some story and I think, well, maybe it is a little worse than I realize.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I know my university best. I mean, the vast majority of people on campus are reasonable people who want to continue going as we've been going for 250, 300 years. But I do think that there's been a falling away of an appreciation for what I think, again, is the vital center in a way, where people on the left and the right, no matter how much they disagree about how the liberal values of the university ought to be applied, they agree that the values are important. I'm a little nervous that consciousness may have fallen away over the last 20, 30 years inside the universities and indeed inside other institutions as well. I can't put my finger on it quite yet, Bill. I'm not quite sure how much of a threat it is or how much of a problem it's going to be. But it's something I sense out there, that there is an illiberalism, as you put it, that, it's on the right, too. I mean, it's on both extremes. But since I'm on the left, I'm more worried about what's happening there, because I think it stifles a lot. And it's just something that shouldn't be there. I'm generally hopeful about it. I think that we're in a moment now of maximum stress. And ideas that may have been out on the margins because in part of with the social media and so forth, they can escape and get out there. And I think people are basically, we're in the middle of a freak out. And my guess, my hope is that if the election turns out in November, turns out the way that I hope it does, that there will be some calming effect. that the turmoil that we've been living through, almost daily turmoil we've been living through, given the given Trump's style. I mean, it makes one crazy. If the kids say crazy making, well, it's crazy making. And I think that just to get rid of that would be a step in the right direction in terms of restoring some sense of normality to the cultural and the political scene. Trump's a very big problem, but he's not the cause of everything, right? I mean, all this stuff led up to him is still going to be there, as you say. So we've got a lot to do.
And in the universities, are people, I mean, do you feel that some people who want to defend, you know, free speech, free inquiry, heterodox opinions, are stepping up and saying so, or aren't? Yes. How bad is the intimidation? Do people at Princeton feel it when they walk into a classroom? Do students feel it when they're going to be, you know, exposed by something, an opinion they offer at 10:30 at night in a dorm room, and it'll be on social media and so forth? That alarms me a little bit.
It should. I mean, you know, we don't have classrooms anymore, so it's
good point. Right.
But insofar as I've never seen it. It's never hit me, but I've gotten a little rumbles about people being upset. Social media changes everything, and unless you're connected to it, I'm not. I have these sites that my publishers make me put up, but I don't attend to them very much. But I mean, I've heard reports of just viciousness on social media. I don't think that the universities are necessarily any more prone to that than other places, but it's there. And you hear these terrible stories. I think that there's been healthy replies to all of that stuff coming from the faculty, at least here in Princeton. And there's a dialogue that's going on. So we'll see where it goes. I don't think that the universities are about to repudiate everything they've stood for since the Renaissance or what have you. I don't think they're about to do that. I think they're feeling great strain, though, and you know, the university's integrated late, and integration is always uneasy. I mean, you know, it's never simple, and it can take decades to solve these things, and we're just going through that. But I think that there are the people that I know that are in charge. Show great, devotion, I think, to the ultimate mission of the university. And that's all you can ask for.
Yeah, I guess in the late 60s, early 70s, the complaint by liberals or old-fashioned liberals about the reaction to the new left wasn't that the old-fashioned liberals agreed with the new left. It was that they didn't stand up to the new left when the new left went sort of over the line. And I guess that would be the question today. I mean, where were you? Were you involved in the Woodrow Wilson School debate? Since you're at Princeton, you're a famous American historian at Princeton. Presumably, someone asked your opinion.
it depends on what stage of the debate. I mean, early on, this all started 5 years ago with the.
Just to be clear, so the Wilson School is the graduate school of public policy at Princeton. So named after Wilson, a famous Princeton president who became president of the United States, a fairly important figure.
And an especially important figure at Princeton because he was an important president here. But, you know, the school was named after him not simply because of his, you know, legacy at Princeton, but because he is best known for his a role in international affairs and, you know, his attempt with the League of Nations and so forth to, reorder the world in a more just way. And I mean, it's why he's remembered in Europe. I mean, there are monuments to Woodrow Wilson in Central and Eastern Europe, all over the place, or even in Paris. You know, are they going to rename the avenue? I don't know, but never mind. So was I involved? Yeah. 5 years ago when this all started, the university, I thought, did a very wise thing, which was to step back and have a consult with everybody. And they certainly consulted with me. And I have my own views about Wilson, which I was happy to share, but there were people who knew much more about it than I did. So I referred them to the people who did. And they did consult with those people. And they got a balanced view of what Wilson was from American historians. And I know that they actually... Not only did they contact them, but they listened to them. What was worked out in the end was something that I didn't like it exactly, but that's what a compromise is. So, but it was a workable compromise. This time, it was much more sudden, and this is again why I caution that we're in a different kind of American moment. If you want to talk about history, we're in the grips of something much more like. I don't know. I mean, the word hysteria, it sounds very strong, It is strong, but it's something in that direction of emotionalism running ahead of facts, and facts trying to catch up with emotions, and that old American trait, a love of purity, comes out. So I've said to friends that the only two novelists I know who could capture this, what we're going through now, would have been Nathaniel Hawthorne and Philip Roth. And they both understood hysteria extremely well. And then, of course, among the historians, and this is another thing we could talk about, actually, is the historian who best understood this was Richard Hofstadter. And as it happens, I was bugging the people at the Library of America for a long time that they didn't have enough historians on their list. That, you know, that great history is indeed a literary art, and there were many great American historians who wrote beautifully. Besides, Henry Adams and Francis Parkman and so forth. So they were persuaded, and so they're going to be doing more historians. And the first one they did was Richard Hofstadter, and so I edited. I hope we're going to get all of Hofstadter's work out, but the one they wanted to bring out right away was Anti-Intellectualism in American Life and The Paranoid Style in American Politics. Probably the books that he's best known for, at least among people who write about politics today. The Paranoid Style has practically become a byword, right? Right. Not always well-defined, but it's out there. So he understood what was going on, this mania, practically, for purity captures people, and it leads to a mentality which is almost, people become hunters, heresy hunters, and the heresy hunters are out there. And, I just saw a piece today, this is going to be more with the Republicans than with the left, but I mean, poor Liz Cheney's taking it on the chin from people inside her own caucus for not being, for being a heretic, in effect, for not being, Trumpian enough. Well, that's part of there's a political reason for that, I understand, but there's also an American part of that which gets unleashed. And I think we're seeing that unleashed big time right now in the culture. That people are taking advantage of it, that there's an opening, there's a political opening. There's no leadership, there's no political leadership. And into the breach step the hustlers and the demagogues and all the rest who are going to take advantage of that. And that's where you get this mania, getting out of control. So I'm hoping that we're in a moment that we're going to look back on and the morning after will happen. Everybody will say what happened. But I just hope that there'll be, to put it slightly differently, no matter what happens, we're going to be facing enormous challenges on a scale that I don't think either of us have known in our own lifetimes, mm-hmm. Bill. I mean, if you're born in the early 50s, we had many challenges along the way. We had the war in Vietnam, we had civil rights, all of this stuff, but nothing like what the pandemic, the epidemic, the, I call it the contagion, has caused, just as a public health crisis. Then the economics of that have yet to be understood. The downfall is going to be extraordinary, especially the longer it continues. And then you got the racial stuff in the background of all of that. Now, those are three gigantic challenges that no matter who is elected is going to have to face. And as a nation, we're going to have to face. And again, if we can turn our attention to facing those challenges, then I think we'll be better off. And if we can do so in a calm way, we can get somewhere.
It's interesting you mentioned Hofstadter, who I read some as when I was in college. My parents knew him pretty well, so I knew him slightly as a kind of impressive adult figure, in my folks' apartment. I guess I assume the book that I remember the best, because I'm not a historian, I guess, is The American Political Tradition and the Men Who Made It, those wonderful, fairly short essays about, I don't know, a dozen or so American political figures. I guess I assumed that's what Lewis had in his backpack, but is that wrong? I mean, maybe...
That is.
It was that book.
It was that book. Yeah. 65. So it's interesting. Hofstadter actually shows up in Selma. There's an historians group. There's a second Selma march after the beating. Then King leads a second march, which actually makes it to Montgomery. But there was a contingent of historians there. and included C. Van Woodward, John Hope Franklin, and Richard Hofstadter.
Wow.
And there's a story about that march where they were in a bus and they were being driven somewhere from one church to a staging area, something like that. And the bus driver momentarily lost control, and the bus swerved. And Hofstadter, apparently with great sanguinity, looked up and said, "Be careful. You'll wipe out the entire liberal interpretation of American history if you continue to drive like this." So he was there, yeah. But American political, the books that I'm writing, that I published just now, were coming out just at that moment, right, in 65, 66. He was very alarmed by Barry Goldwater, Hofstadter was, and so he wrote a lot of pieces about the Goldwater campaign. But the anti-intellectualism had really come out of the 50s and McCarthyism more than anything else, I think.
Right.
But these were all coming out right then.
Yeah, the liberal tradition, of course, reminds us that there were other traditions before, too, Charles Beard and stuff. So it's not as if liberalism in the broad sense has always been so dominant
in American
history or historiography.
That's right.
But you mentioned the Civil War before. As you said, the way the Civil War still continues. But I suppose the Civil War itself is a continuation, obviously, of problems left unresolved at the founding. And then it's a question of which founding, the founding of 1776 or 1789 or 1619. So say a word about that. So you were obviously tell us a little about the 1619 project, your reaction to it. You wrote eloquently about it. What reactions you got to your reaction to it and so forth. I think it's an interesting moment in the last few years.
It was an interesting controversy, to say the least. I ran across it about a year ago when it first appeared in the Times magazine.
Say a word about what it is.
It is a series of articles. They devoted the entire issue of the Sunday magazine to this project that they've gotten going, which is to try to recenter American history around slavery, to say that the way that we've understood history, including its landmarks, its dates, and so forth, is really incorrect. That slavery is the essence of American history. It's the foundation of American history. Slavery and the racism that goes along with it is foundational to American history, and they were going to try to re-examine American history from that vantage point, and then also show
the 400th anniversary of
In 1619, the very first, basically a Dutch ship delivered 20. They had been enslaved Africans who were bought. Their condition was complicated as to what they were slaves or not, but that's not the issue. So it's thought of traditionally as the beginnings of slavery in North America. So that was the point. They called themselves the 1619 Project because if slavery was foundational to the United States, to American history, well then 1619 was the date that you wanted to begin American history at, not 1776, not 1787, and so forth.
Or not even the Mayflower or all the other...
Not 1620, you see, so it was 1 year before the Mayflower,
right,
was 1619. Not 1607, though, for reasons that I don't understand. When I read it, there was just things in there that were just historically wrong. I mean, just factually wrong. And I was surprised that the Times would let these things slip by. And some of them were tendentiously wrong, should put it that way, that suggested that perhaps there was a little bit of ideology in here, not just telling the story. I mean, look, it's an ideological stance to shift it anyway, but that's okay. It could start there and then lead to great enlightenment, if you want to do that, but you should get your facts right. And then a number of my colleagues had the same reaction, which was, look, historians for a long time have been trying to grapple with the centrality of slavery to American history and have established the centrality of slavery to American history. And it's great to continue that and to move it and to shift things and to change our understandings of the entire narrative, of the entire story. That's fantastic. That's what we're all trying to do. But that you ought to get your facts right. First of all, get the history right. And it ought to pay attention to nuances in American history that have to be there. I understand that you ask an historian a question, it'll give you five different answers because it's complicated. That's our usual line. I'm not trying to say that we should, you know, revert to that, but nevertheless, some sense of irony, some sense of paradox, that this was, you know, this was going against that, that it was trying to eliminate nuance and paradox. I mean, to me, and right away, I thought, well, the United States didn't even exist in 1619. This is the British Empire that you're talking about. And if you want to talk about slavery in the British Empire, well, that's an interesting question. But that's not the United States. You know, the United States doesn't come into existence until the Revolution. Now, by the time you get to the American Revolution, and by the time you get to the Constitution, it's in fact the Americans. The American colonies have given birth to the first anti-slavery movement in the Atlantic world. I mean, it had begun with the Quakers very early on in 1688 or so. But there were actually in 1760s and 1770s, there were plenty of Northerners who were railing against slavery, thinking, saying, in fact, that how can we, you know, call ourselves lovers of liberty if we have these slaveholders among us? So, and in fact, the Northerners were starting the very first emancipation, successful emancipation projects, again, in Atlantic history. You know, the very first gradual emancipation law was passed in Pennsylvania in 1780. The first constitution, actually, that banned adult slavery was enacted in Vermont in 1777. The first anti-slavery society in the history of the world was established in Philadelphia in 1775, about 5 days before Lexington and Concord. So this is America, and it's not that America is anti-slavery, it's that there's a fight, there's an argument from the very beginning. There is no one thing about America and slavery. To say that slavery and racism are foundational to America obliterates the fact that when the United States is being formed, there's a great deal of anti-slavery out there as well. Not all of it coming from the enslaved. I mean, of course, the slaves are not terribly into slavery, and there are rebellions, and there's all sorts of things going on. But even apart from that, and in part, in fact, playing off of that, in Massachusetts in particular, its freedom suits by African slaves or African-American slaves are pushing white people to take an anti-slavery stance. But the point is, there's always a struggle. And the struggle is there from the beginning. And that's what I wanted to make sure people understood. And that's not there in the 1619 Project. Indeed, in the Constitution, the book that you very graciously mentioned earlier, Bill, is an attempt to go back and look at the debates of what happened in 1787. Now, you know, our listeners might know that, you know, the Constitution is thought of as a pro-slavery document because of various compromises that were made in it. The notorious Three-Fifths Clause, the delay in ending the transatlantic African slave trade, and there's a Fugitive Slave Clause in there. But looking back at the debates, I found that interpretation is not the whole story by any means, and that in fact even those compromises were more salvaging jobs by the South to reclaim something, to get something they could take back home to their constituents to sell the Constitution, particularly the slave trade. They didn't want the federal government to have any power over the slave trade at all, but the Northerners insisted. But at the key to it was that the
Constitution, just to be clear, anticipates or allows it to be ended in what, 1808 or something, isn't that right? And
that's correct.
Which the federal government did.
Yeah. Correct. And everybody kind of knew that it was going to happen because the Virginians were against the slave trade for good reasons and bad reasons. But it doesn't matter. And Virginia was the largest colony, largest state. So everybody knew this was going to happen. 20 years, it's a long time, and they got a lot, you know, they did a lot of importing of slaves. But nevertheless, it was the first blow against the transatlantic slave trade, again, in the Atlantic world, undertaken in the name of a government. I mean, that was it. It said, we are giving Congress the power to do this in 20 years, if they want to do it. Now, compromised, mottled, not what you'd want, sure. But given against the millennia of the history of slavery before this, where it was all taken for granted, this is, to me, actually, I see it very, very differently. And I think I can persuade people to see it differently. But most of all, the framers, or rather the majority of the framers at the convention, I went through the Madison's notes very, very carefully. And James Madison at the convention, as you know, he was a very important figure at the convention in 1787. But he kept notes. He kept notes of what was going on. It's the only quasi-reliable account we have of what happened behind closed doors. And there are problems with them, and he kept revising them thereafter, and they're a problematic source. But taking all those problems into account, I went back and looked at the debates about slavery. And what they showed to me was that the majority of the convention was determined to keep slavery out of national law, to keep it purely a state operation, which meant that it was not going to be enshrined as an American institution. It was going to be at law. It was going to be left up to the states to deal with. We're not going to deal with their property, you know, laws anymore than we're going to deal with New York's property laws or Pennsylvania's property laws. But in doing so, they gave the federal government a great deal of power to do what it wanted to do about slavery under its own jurisdiction. What I mean by that is, in those areas where the federal government had jurisdiction, like the national territories, for example, or on the high seas, or in the what was going to become later on the federal city, it didn't exist then, but it was going to become that. Those are areas where the federal government did not have to respect slavery; could get rid of it, and that was what the fight led to the Civil War was all about. You know, is slavery allowed to the national territories or not? That was going to. There's the rub. That's why the South seceded. But the framers were very clear that they did not want to allow slavery to have that kind of national character in law, and that Congress could take action against slavery if it so wanted. And the North was in the majority and was going to remain in the majority. So it took 70 years. It took 80 years before push came to shove. But push came to shove, in part because of what the framers had done, and coming out of the, you know, if you go back to into the 19th century, and people who were listening to who might be more familiar, in fact, with the arguments about slavery then, there were kind of two views about the Constitution and slavery in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. One was the view that actually most of my colleagues hold, which was that the Constitution enshrined slavery in the United States, and the Constitution was a pro-slavery document. Among the people who endorsed that idea were John C. Calhoun, for obvious reasons, and William Lloyd Garrison, for obvious reasons. The people who argued against that point of view were included Abraham Lincoln, upon which he based his campaign in 1860, precisely on this question of the Constitution, and his sometimes friend, sometimes Frederick Douglass. Now, it's not that I'm trying to say that Douglass was and Lincoln were right, and because they weren't completely right either about what happened. But nevertheless, they were more right than right. John C. Calhoun and Garrison. So that's the history about all of this. It has tremendous impact today, though. And in the 1619 Project, getting back to that, they, of course, take the view that the Constitution was, you know, wholly a pro-slavery document and there was no struggle going on. And that the only struggle that exists is the struggle that really matters is the struggle of African Americans against their own oppression. And I think as an historian, it's very important to make that point that there are, you know, sometimes, you know, it's as if African Americans had nothing to do with their own liberation. Well, that's plainly not the case. But to think that that's the only thing that's going on, to ignore Abraham Lincoln or make Abraham Lincoln into a kind of, you know, softy on all of this stuff, that misleads as well. You have to be able to have both of those ideas in your head at the same time or else you're not going to understand it. So
it always seemed to me, so, I mean, I don't know nearly as much about it, but the Northwest Ordinance, which was once considered a kind of core law, I think it's featured at the beginning of the U.S. Code after the Declaration of the mm-hmm. Constitution, passed by the Articles of Confederacy Congress, yeah. I think in 1787, right. and then repassed yeah. in the first session of the U.S. Congress, banned slavery. I mean, it does other things. It's very important because it shows you the states are going to be admitted as equal states, so it's the kind of American
right.
mode of liberal empire, if you want to use that term. But it also banned slavery in all the states that are going to come out of that, which is a lot, right? I mean, Ohio and Michigan
yeah.
and all these
five
places.
States, or is it?
And and that's not yeah. inevitable, of course. They could have been neutral, as Stephen Douglas, 70 years later, I guess, wanted to be about, well, let the settlers of those territories or the new citizens decide. But they did go out of their way to ensure that the first wave of expansion of the Union, at least, would increase the strength of the anti-slavery forces, which the Southerners were aware of. I mean, and didn't like for certain reasons, right? I mean,
yeah, you're exactly right, Bill. And
so what did the 1619 people say in response to that? Well, I was just not as important, or...
I you'd have to ask them.
I don't know,
I haven't gotten much response.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, well, but the labor shortage is important. I mean, look, and even before that, it grew out of a proposal that Jefferson was pushing in 1784 to ban slavery in all of the territories. Northwest Ordinance covered the northwest areas north of the Ohio River. But Jefferson was pushing to keep slavery out of all of the Western territories.
Is that right? So Jefferson's usually regarded as, I think, with some justice later on, as a little soft on the too accommodating on slavery. So that's interesting.
Yes,
I didn't realize
If Thomas Jefferson had died in 1787, he would have been regarded as one of the few great white anti-slavery people in Western history.
Hmm.
Things changed thereafter, But it goes back to 1784, and of course the Northwest Ordinance was crucial to the anti-slavery cause thereafter. And it was a kind of repudiation of, well, it was the standing proof that Congress had the power to keep slavery out of the territories if it wanted to. This was something that the Calhounites denied, and something that sort of the Garrisonians kind of went along with too. They couldn't explain the Northwest Ordinance any better than the 1619 Project can.
Hmm. And so what was so you wrote, I think, a long review essay, in a sense, of the 1619 Project essays. You and your but there was also you and other distinguished historians, Gordon Wood, wrote about this. And say a little about the reaction to your reaction and the reaction to the reaction, just as a...
Okay. What happened was, I mean, I'd seen this, as I said, back in last summer. And I was honored enough to give the Philip Roth lecture, actually, in Newark in the fall. In November, and I decided to make slavery my topic, coming off of something that he wrote about in The Plot Against America.
Hmm.
And along the way, in passing, I tweaked the 1619 Project as being, you know, not understanding something about the character of slavery, being cynical about all of this. Then I looked around, and a bunch of my colleagues were giving interviews on a Trotskyist website. God knows. I mean, you know, you never know where people are going to come from.
Right.
These are. You know, Gordon Wood is not a Trotskyist, shall we say the least. Right. But this was the place, this was the port in the storm where they could actually, you know, make their criticisms. At any rate, I saw that they had done this, and I thought, well, we really ought to write a letter to the Times and just talk about the factual errors. I mean, we're not going to get into interpretation. So we wrote this letter. We tried to get more people to sign. This was a sign of, you know, of fear, I think, of the Times as an institution, and perhaps of people didn't want to break ranks or something. At any rate, the five of us wrote this letter to the Times. They published it very nicely and had a very long, I think the response by the editor of the magazine, whose name is Jake Silverstein, was five times as long as our letter. I mean, our letter was pretty concise, but mm-hmm. it went on and on and on about it and defended it. And then there was just sort of a crazy next few months where, in fact, it turns out that they had checked some of the facts of this and had been told that these facts were incorrect, and they went ahead with it anyway. And it was all getting very messy. Then, of course, they were given the Pulitzer Prize for, you know, who knows, whatever reasons. But, you know, it was a real argument. Unfortunately, I think, given this place that we were at politically at that moment, it was hard to have a really good dialogue. I mean, I regret that we couldn't have an honest dialogue about what happened. I later ended up replying to the long reply in a long piece in The Atlantic, in which I basically made the argument that, you know, facts matter in talking about history. So it's still unsettled. The issues are still out there. We'll see what happens. But this what should we call it? This view of American history, this very narrow view of American history, to my mind, and cynical view of American history, is out there in all kinds of ways, not just on the history of slavery and race. And it's just something that, as a historian, I have to put up with, and as a history teacher, professor of history, I have to put up with. I think that there's been a, over the last 30 years or so, there's been a souring on the United States. I mean, I think it probably dates back to the Vietnam War and all the things you talked about with the New Left in the 1960s. And I think there's been an abiding sourness about the United States. I don't want to say anti-American because some of it's not. I mean, it's not that simple. If it was that simple, you could just see it that way. But there's a kind of, I think there's a cynicism about everything, actually. I mean, I think we're living in a very cynical time. And, but, you know, if you're going to be cynical about everything, you're going to be cynical first about your own country, I suppose. And, but as an historian, that's a problem. That's a problem. Not because what they say about the, you know, terrible things that the United States has done isn't true. It's just that we have to understand them, not indict them. You know, I mean, I'm not here as a prosecutor. I'm here as an historian, and I want you to understand why these things happened. Because if you simply indict and if you don't understand, then you can't actually do anything. I mean, insofar as history should be the basis for informed citizenship, if you've got it wrong, then you're going to make mistakes.
How worried are you about, I mean, you're teaching at Princeton, and I don't know if Gordon Wood is still teaching or not, of Brown and so forth, but I mean, how worried are you that this kind of sensibility you're describing, whatever the particular political views of individual historians, and there were Marxists who, Eugene Genovese, who were great historians and believed in free argument about many things, and they're conservatives.
The Marxists are on our side. I mean, they're the ones who are giving us the...
That's funny, isn't it?
My colleagues.
So how worried are you about... You know, younger generations of historians as college professors, also about the teaching in the high schools. I mean, some conservatives, sometimes they sound a little over the top to me, but then I actually see some of the curriculum and I think, oof, I don't know. I mean, how much are we in a Howard Zinn, world of teaching history in our civic, beyond the elite universities, but I mean, in our culture as a whole?
I think it's out there in the culture. Frankly, I don't know enough. I haven't seen enough high school curricula. I mean, people boast that the 1619 Project, in fact, is that's going to have curricula all over the place. I don't know. I mean, what I do know is what my stepson does. He just took AP American History, and it was pretty damn good. And I'm happy to say he did very well on the exam, but I mean, it was damn good. And now Princeton High School is an exceptionally good high school. It's not the run of the mill by any means. But, you know, that's going to be one way of looking at things. And if he was getting junk history, I was going to be the first person to complain. So, I mean, obviously, there are schools that are doing it very, very well. And the students who come my way as freshmen, that's the other way I can see
it. Say a word about that. You've been teaching at Princeton for what? A long time. So you've seen
40 years.
You have a lot of comparative data, at least within that slice.
I don't think it's changed a whole lot. The kids have changed somewhat. I mean, there are more African-American students and so forth. That's good. There are more, you know, obviously many more women than there were back when I started, when they had just finished desegregating. But no, I think that the kids I see, I'm incredibly lucky. I mean, I get the cream of the crop, so I'm seeing the very best. And they come with, you know, pretty open minds, at least to my courses. I'd say I'm optimistic, Bill. I am. I don't think that... I think that if... as long as we have a place to have a hearing, you know, we will be able to argue down error. And I think that as long as the universities remain, you know, what they are and have been, I don't think that there's going to be a problem with that. I mean, I still hope that I'll be able to convert everybody to my book, but that's every historian thinks they can do that. But you notice in my slight hesitation is that I'm not completely convinced that's the case.
I mean, for me, I guess, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There are simplifications that are out there that, are to say the least unfortunate. But you know, as I say, that can be an opportunity as much as everything else. You know, I mean, Princeton is also the place where you have somebody like Cornel West, back when he was still teaching here, and Robbie George, you know, be debating each other, you know, and having it out that way. And I think that's the spirit that I think all these things ought to be dealt with. And so you seize them not with disappointment, but you see them as opportunities, you know, and you seize them a chance to have an argument. And argument often can produce enlightenment.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I guess it's the mob spirit that's most worrisome. And you see it on the right and the left, incidentally, as you sort of alluded to earlier, and I'd say the intolerant right and the intolerant left. And it's, you know, but even if universities are problematic for some of us that have been for a long time, you know, there are other historians who aren't at universities who write good books, and they, and
yeah, well,
then
that,
people
yes.
do play, have put on bestseller, you know, hugely successful musicals and so forth. So there are ways that people can access history that's not, even if the course that I don't particularly like, the course some kid is getting in 10th grade or whatever, or even perhaps yeah. at other places than Princeton, even in their introductory or advanced American history classes. But I guess what worries about the mob thing, yeah. because it sort of just suppresses even the, gee, I'm going to go see if there's another point of view, because you just can't either see it or you feel awkward even recommending it or suggesting it.
I agree with that. And some of the things I've seen on YouTube with the at other universities, there's one at Evergreen State in Washington that was particularly shocking. Yes, you do see that. I don't see it here, but you do see that around the country, and it is absolutely worrisome. The mob rule, you know, always is. The thing that's so ironic about all of this, of course, is that, you know, some of the people who are the you know, the most strident and the boldest and all the rest of it, no one's ever going to read their work. I mean, no one outside, the talk about Mandarinism. I mean, it's a kind of weird, revolutionary Mandarinism. So you're right. I mean, not just in terms of popular culture, but in terms of, you know, who are the historians who are read. You know, some of us can cross over, but not many. And so I think, for example, getting back to U.S. Grant, I think Ron Chernow has done more for public understanding of U.S. Grant than any academic historian has. As good as the academic historians have often been, he's out there and he can do that and do it very, very well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing, maybe we can close on a somewhat upbeat note, too, is that I always remind my conservative friends who are, oh, it's gone so downhill, no one takes the Federalists right. seriously anymore, or Lincoln, and I'm a huge, I wrote my dissertation partly on the Federalists and was hugely influenced by Lincoln and Jaffa and Lincoln and so forth, and
sure,
Frederick
sure.
Douglass. But having said all that, it's, of course, they were, if you go back slightly before you and I guess, showed up in colleges and universities, the dominant schools did not take the Federalists very seriously and did not take Lincoln seriously. And it was a weird combination of, I guess, Marxist reductionism, the property holdings,
right.
and
right.
Dunning School lost causism,
yep.
and
yep.
the Lincoln-Douglas debates were about nothing. And I mean,
yes.
I don't know that much about this, but I saw it, and Jaffa discusses this in the opening chapter of Crisis of the House Divided. And so it's, I guess these things do change, right? I mean, it's not as if we were dropped into a typical history class in 1925 and either the North or the South, I guess, right? We would mm-hmm, find a mm-hmm. lot to complain about. And
I think that's right. I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, between, you know, Iberian reductionism and the lost cause, there's not a lot to choose from. So there is progress. We are out there. And our points of view are being written about. And yeah, I think there's lots of debate going on. So in the end, though, I'm encouraged by the turn towards history. Not so much in the colleges, because that's another problem. It's nothing to do with history. It has to do with people's fear, economic fears. They're not taking history as much as they used to. But in the country as a whole, there is a thirst for historical knowledge. You know, and you see it going back to the very beginning of our conversation. You see it in the monuments debates. You see it in all of these things. People are very, very hungry to grapple with their history, perhaps more in the United States than in any other country that we can think of, at least big Western countries. So that to me, again, is a great opportunity. And it's why I like doing things like your show here. I mean, it's just a great chance for us to instruct historically. If Americans have a problem, their consciousness is not terribly historical. That much is true. I mean, Henry James is not wrong about that. We don't have the ruins. We don't have the old stuff. We think of the future. We don't think of the past. That's not something we've cultivated. But if we can cultivate it more and open it up more as a form of public discussion, that would be fantastic. And that would mean that you're not following any one line, but you can have debates about these things, much as we've had debates about the monuments. It's purely emblematic, perhaps, or symbolic as that is. It's nevertheless gets people thinking and talking, and that's fine. So let's have those conversations, but to have them informed by history is something that hasn't been done terribly well in America up until now. Maybe now America's finally old enough that we can do that.
That's a good note to end on, both somewhat upbeat and sober, though. And we'll have to come back sometime and do a conversation where I'd really like to get your recommendations, actually, about different things to read on different topics. Oh, sure. and figures. Sure. And you know, I think it would be very helpful for our listeners. But that would probably be another hour, so maybe we should let everyone go now and come back in a few months and have that second conversation. Plus, you can update us at all on how things are going.
We'll see how things are going
virtually at Princeton and in the country as a whole. Sean Willans, thank you very much for joining me today.
It was great to be here. I hope to do it again soon. Take care, Bill.
Thanks, Sean. And thank you for joining us in Conversations.